All right. Thank you. So this is based on a joint work with Charles Favre, and it's most of what I will say is in a paper called Eigenvaluations. So the idea is look at you want to do local dynamics in C2, so you have a germ of a self-map of C2. And there are many kinds of dynamics you can have. And usually you have a rough classification using just the differential at the origin. So then you can give like attracting fixed point, repelling fixed point, saddle fixed point, parabolic, semi-parabolic, and et cetera, et cetera. But here we look at a kind of an extreme case. So we're going to say that F is super attracting. I guess the correct definition is that, say, the differential at the origin is nilpotent, which I guess just means that if you replace F by the iterate, then it really is constantly equal to zero. And we have to assume that F, for to make anything interesting, that F is a dominant map. So, I mean, otherwise, in this case, F will just map all the neighborhood of C2 onto just a curve. And for some of the arguments, just to cheat a little bit, I might, or just to format a few things, I might assume that F is actually finite. The results are fine anyway, but just there are some kind of small modifications that have to be made, which I don't want to make. Okay, so let's see. All right. All right, so what do you want to do with these fixed points? At the end of the day, we're going to get to a tool, which is these valuations that can be used for a number of situations to study kind of local behavior, and especially in C2 then, at the origin, to study singularities of pluripotent harmonic functions and a few other things. But here it's for dynamics. But I still wanted to mention some results in this setting. So what you do here is you assume it's a super-attracting fixed point, so you can look at its Taylor expansion. So the first term, these are just homogeneous mappings, so of degree C and degree C plus 1, et cetera. So just the Taylor expansion. And the first order is you just say call this a C of F. That's the order of vanishing at the origin. And super-attracting just means that then at least when you replace F by F squared, then this thing is bigger than 1. And what you can just check from this form, if you want, that if you take a f to the n plus mth iterate of f, then you have a super multiplicative behavior like this. It's just pretty obvious from plugging things in. And that means, by kind of general principles, that you can, if you take the nth root of the c of fn, then that limit will exist, and it's some number, which is kind of asymptotic. Somehow measures asymptotically how fast orbits are attracted to the origin, at least in this kind of algebraic sense. Okay, so one result here you can prove is, so I'll try to say something about how you get this, so that you can bound that this, it's not only kind of asymptotically exponential like this, but in fact you have a very precise bound that, well, one bound is actually obvious, but you have the other bound that there is a C of Fn is bounded from below by some constant times C infinity to the m. And then, there are some other things you can prove, that in fact this C infinity is a quadratic integer, and so it satisfies an equation like this with A and B integers. And if you look at it, I'm not going to write out the details here, but if you do a specific example, F of xy is y comma xy, of course this, for a monomial map like this, this becomes just kind of a taking powers of a matrix or something. It's just you can write everything explicitly, and you see that the number that's going to show up here is like the Fibonacci sequence, and you get the golden mean as C infinity, so which is a quadratic integer. All right, so here's some of the main a tool that's been used for quite some time to study local dynamics in C2 is that you use blow-ups. And, I mean, we've seen blow-ups yesterday in my talk and before that a bunch of times here. So we're going to see even more today. So here's what you can try to do is you have the map from C2, then you just blow up the origin once to replace 0 by exceptional divisor, just a P1, and then you get an induced dynamical system on the space upstairs. Of course, now there's no reason for this to be holomorphic anymore, but it's some kind of meromorphic map or germ. And one particular case when this is kind of useful is if you have a parabolic fixed point, in the sense that it's also tangent to that entity, so the differential is the identity. Well, then somehow this is a nice tool looking at this map on the blow up. Then it is holomorphic, and it's a kind of nice tool for trying to analyze the dynamics downstairs. But here's kind of the opposite, or kind of another extreme situation in the superattracting case. So again, there's no reason for this to be holomorphic. And unless you're very lucky here, then the image of the exceptional divisor is typically just a point, well, on the exceptional divisor. And there's also, so you contract the exceptional divisor, and there is some indeterminacy points as well. So just blowing up once is not going to be good enough. Well, we can try, well, if you just blow up finitely many times, so what can happen then? It's probably not going to solve all the problems, but you can try. So here, this is going to be a composition of finitely many blow-ups, and all of them are somehow above the origin, so you don't blow up things outside the origin. So. The question is, can you make, now by finitely many choices here, in some clever way, can you make this nice? Well, you have to, depends on what your expectations are, so you can't expect it to be holomorphic or anything. But what you can do, so here is a theorem, which that's going to be a counterpart, although this is going to have counterparts when I look at polynomial maps of C2, and then you can actually, this is a very useful. Anyway, here what you can do is you can pick this, I'll just have a picture here as well. So what you can find, you can pick this composition of blow-ups in such a way. So then you have a bunch of exceptional divisors here, a bunch of P1s kind of putting together in a connected way. And you can pick a point on the exceptional divisor, so this point P here, which I put it to be an intersection point of two exceptional divisors, such that the induced map upstairs happens to be holomorphic at that point, which is not obvious that it will be. So, and also it's a fixed point. So you get a fixed point germ at that point. Well, so maybe that's not so good. You started with a fixed-point germ, so what have you gained? Well, the point is that this can be much nicer. It's called a rigid germ, which means that the critical set is somehow well-behaved here. It's contained in, this is a little bit too general. Really, in this case, this critical set is going to be contained locally in those two curves that you see there. And the critical set is then totally invariant as well. And then, what you can do further here, I'm not going to write down, but once you have that situation, there is a classification of rigid germs by Charles Favre, which he did much earlier. So you can actually get normal forms for the dynamics there. So you can find good coordinates at that point. And I'm not going to write down the list of possible normal forms, but the easiest one is that you just get a monomial map. So there are coordinates ZW at F at that point P upstairs, so that map, the map becomes a monomial map. So that's kind of as nice as you can hope for. In this setting. Okay. So I'll try to explain. How you can get to that. That will be one of the goals of the talk, to try to explain how you can choose this blow-up. And also this the first theorem about the C of Sn being roughly exponential. Right. So I don't know a good algorithm for just kind of finding this inductively or something. Maybe a posteriori you can show that it works. Usually when you desingularize curves or something else, you kind of have an algorithm for you. You measure and you blow up where you see some bad behavior, and then you have a way of measuring how much you have improved, and then you show that finally you have improved well enough that you're done. But here we don't do that, but rather in some sense you look at all possible blow-ups at the same time. I need a little bit of notation here. So I'm going to call an exceptional prime or exceptional prime divisor that's just an irreducible component of the exceptional divisor of some compositional blowups. And maybe I'll just say blowup for compositional blowups. So, you see here, right, so there's a convention that you, so for this I'm going to identify an exceptional prime with its strict transform with further blowups. So here I've blown up the origin, and I created this exceptional prime, and then I blow up some point, in this case on P, you get a new exceptional divisor, but the strict transform is still there, and I still call it E. So you have to be able to defend, I mean, if you work on cohomology, sometimes you don't want to use exactly this convention, but here I do. Well, so there's a fact here, is the kind of the same result by Zariski as before, that in some sense F will map exceptional primes to exceptional primes. So given, here's a C2 at the origin. I've blown up the origin in some way, and you have found your exceptional divisor E. Well, so then if you would just kind of go the map from here down there, then it's going to collapse all the exceptional divisor to the origin. But you can find some blow up in the target space so that in fact your E is not contracted, it's sent onto some E prime. So that means that you have some kind of dynamics on exceptional primes. So given any exceptional prime, you can find its image.
Yeah.
These are different blowups. Yeah, so that's the problem later on is going to be that when you have the same blowup, you have many more constraints. So there's a corresponding thing as well for this would be that if you fix your pi prime, then you can find a pi so that the map F twiddle is holomorphic. But I'm going to indirectly use that as well. Right. So how can you? So this kind of gives a dynamics on the set of exceptional primes, and then you can try to. Well, how can you study this? Well, one version is to try to look at this Riemann-Zariski point of view that I used in the last lecture. I'm not really going to do that because I think there are various. It's not exactly the same, and I haven't actually written out in detail. But there are some subtle differences. Instead, I'm going to take a point of view evaluations, and then in the third lecture, which will be in a slightly different situation, we'll combine the two methods. So how can we study this dynamics on evaluations or on exceptional primes? Well, the way we do it is we identify these geometric objects by more algebraic objects, these divisor evaluations. You have the ring of, say, holomorphic germs at the origin, and maybe I want to look at the fraction field of that as well. So here's how it works. You pick a holomorphic germ, or maybe a ratio of holomorphic germs, just a quotient, Ord E is evaluation now. It takes in this thing and it spits out a number. So it's an integer, and it's just the order of vanishing of phi along E. So there's a convention here which is standard in people doing evaluations geometrically at least, is that you identify, say you have a holomorphic function downstairs, it's also going to be a holomorphic function when you pull it back. And if it vanishes the origin, it's going to vanish along E. So you kind of identify functions here and functions there. And also for rational functions. So it's kind of so in that way, I could have said that I want to take the order of vanishing of the pullback, but so that's what I mean. So if you vanish at the origin, you're going to vanish at some order along E, and that's the number you want. Okay. So it's a function, so from R, so it takes in a germ and it spits out a positive integer, or it takes out a ratio, a quotient of germs, and spits out an integer, and possibly it could be, I put infinity here just for the silly reason that if you start with a zero germ, then you get order vanishing is infinity, but otherwise not. So here are some axioms you can check for this, so that when you take the product and you get the sum, the order of vanishing is kind of additive in this way. It has this kind of property that when you take the sum of two germs, then the order of vanishing is at least the minimum of the orders of vanishing. And then, of course, we have plus infinity if you put on a zero germ. And if you put on a constant function, it doesn't vanish at all. So that's zero. And then you have another thing that it's, you have a maximum ideal here. So the maximum ideal is just the functions vanishing at the origin. And if you vanish at the origin, it's certainly going to vanish along E as well. And one example here is just the order vanishing at the origin. So, I mean, if you blow up the origin once and pick that E, you get there, then that is an example of evaluation, and it's exactly this, the order of vanishing. Okay. Now, so this set that you can have dynamics on exceptional divisors, well, now you can interpret it slightly differently. So you have some kind of divisorial dynamics here. So it's the same thing. So you have a given F downstairs, holomorphic at the origin, and then you pick some exceptional divisor E. Well, then you can define a new valuation, just to kind of, this is totally formal if you want. I mean, you just kind of define it like this. You pull back the function, so which just means you compose. And, but this fact below means that you have a geometric, I mean, you can really interpret this. So you have the vanish order, you have the E, and by the risk as a result, you can map this onto an E prime. And now if you just check, go through what all this means, it means that this push-forward valuation is just a multiple of the order of vanishing along E prime. And what is this multiple? It's if you take E prime and you pull it back by this meromorphic map, if you want, but you can still do that, you're going to get E with some coefficient K, and then you get maybe some other things. But this coefficient is actually, this is kind of the ramification order of F twiddle along E. Right? So now, you can do is you, well, so why didn't we, maybe I would put a hat here. I want to get rid of that hat later. So let's look at all divisorial valuations, but time some constant. And maybe I could even do integer constant here. I really want positive real constants for this. That's what I want later. Like this. So then you get an induced dynamics in this way. So that gives you some kind of something you can try to study. Well, the problem with this is that this space you get in this way, I mean, of course, there are like infinitely many or uncountably many possible exceptional divisors depending on what choices you, where you choose to blow up. And some of the resulting space is somehow not so nice. So the solution is to make it nice. So you, you embed it in something a little bit larger called V hat. And, well, so you have to do that. So there's a kind of rough analogies that kind of like if you want to, I mean, it's nice to study rational numbers, but sometimes it's nicer to actually complete it to get real numbers. And that's what you want to do. Okay, let's see here. Sorry?
Or like currents of integration and then the set of all positive closed
currents. Yeah, that's another, I guess, analogy here. I think this maybe is a little bit closer in some sense. Ah, well, but yeah, I guess there are many ways, many times you want to enlarge a space to have more freedom. All right, so here's, I mean, if you just, so valuation, so you kind of keep the formal properties here, so you still have this ring of germs at the origin. It has this maximal ideal, I mean, it's a local ring, there's only one maximal ideal, and so this is the germs vanishing at the origin. And then evaluation is, it's just that you take a function, so you take in a germ and you get out a number, maybe plus infinity, and here I really, and insist on plus infinity here. And you have the axioms here, and you want the origin is plus infinity constants are there, right? And now I want this, I want a couple of other conditions as well, which are not implied here, that if you're at, on the, if you have a function vanishing at the origin, you want that to have a strictly positive value. And in fact, so that means that you're centered at the origin. I mean, you can have a specific, I mean, this is kind of a cheating definition, but that's fine. And you say that it's normalized if, in fact, the minimum value you can have on any function vanishing at the origin is 1. And it concretely just means if you have coordinates at the origin, say x and y, then the value on x or the value on y is 1. So the minimum of those two. You don't need to check like all possible values. Right? So then now you know, the new space is you have the all valuation center at the origin, that's with a hat, and then you have the normalized ones that are normalized in this way. And well, basically this is going to be a cone over that. And I don't want to say too much about this, but there is a kind of people, a lot of people look at Berkovich spaces, and this V hat is in some sense a Berkovich space, because usually then you look at semi-norms instead of valuations, but here you get a V you get that in this way. All right, so now, so before we had some divisorial dynamics, so on mapping on divisorial evaluations, but now you can extend this to all evaluations here. So you start with a holomorphic self, the germ of a holomorphic self map, and again, here is when I part something what I I'm going to say here, you have to adjust a little bit if f is not finite, but it's not hard to adjust it. It's just that I don't want to write more than I already do. So I'm just going to maybe assume that f is finite. So then you get an induced map on evaluation. So, I mean, what is, again, what is this thing? It takes in, I mean, you have to, it's just by some kind of duality here. You, what is the image of the push-forward evaluation on a germ? It's the value on the pullback of that germ. Well, so that's nice. Well, there's a problem here. If I want to look at, it turns out that this, I really want to look at this space, the V, here with the normalization. So if you have a normalized germ, well, there's no reason, or it's certainly not, it's not true in general that the image valuation is normalized. But what you can do then is, well, you can make it normalized, and you say this is the normalization factor you have to use. So you put in the image of the maxima ideal. So if you want, this is just, you take your, I mean, if you write f as p, comma q or something in local coordinates, this is just the minimum of the value on p and q, this thing here. See, that's a normalization factor. And I, so here I, this is going to be negative. This is finite if, since f is a finite map. Otherwise, you have to, anyway, have to change something. And then you just divide by this. So then you get an induced map on evaluations. Right. And this has nice kind of functorial behaviors that f, I mean, say under iteration, there's no problem here. It just behaves the correct way. And what is nice here, so if you remember the, I mean, one of the things I wanted to look at is this, well, let me look at the whole thing here, actually. So the, one of the things I wanted to study in was this, order of vanishing at the origin and somehow the first term is the Taylor expansion of f to the n, how that behaves asymptotically. And we saw that that was a super multiplicative cocycle. Or, I mean, c of f of n plus m is greater than or equal to the product of c of fn and c of fn. But here's a way by enlarging, I mean, by looking at a more complicated thing, you get actually a multiplicative cocycle. So the order of vanishing at nu of fn is kind of the product of the orders of vanishing of the image valuations here. So if you just apply this here, I mean, this thing is just a special case when you put in the order zero and then you get a product expression like this. All right. So now, having defined all those things, then you can kind of give an executive summary here of what's going to happen. So, and I want to say, I mean, I do want to explain some of these steps in more detail. But here's the nice thing, I mean, why you want to look at this space at all is because it has a structure of an R tree. So, I mean, R tree you can actually find in many different ways, but, I mean, the picture is just, it kind of looks like this, right? So, it's a bunch of real intervals, but kind of just pasted together so that there are no cycles. So, or if you want, somehow between any two points, there is unique geodesic in some sense here. So, yeah, I mean, there are many different ways you can talk about R trees, and it's going to have the basically all those structures. Okay. So, if I just looked at the divisorial points as V div, somehow this would be corresponding. If you had take one of those intervals in here, and you just somehow take the rational points on that interval, then that's the divisorial evaluations there. Okay, and now the point is that this map, self-map, that you have over here, I guess. Yeah, doesn't work very well. It preserves the structure in some sense. It maps segments to segments. I mean, at least if you subdivide segments, it's just going to work. And just by kind of general arguments, having this in a actually create a weak form, that means that there is a fixed point. It's kind of just by... I should also say that this space here, I mean, I didn't really say that. It's also compact. I mean, it's an R tree, but also all these endpoints are there. So, I mean, having a fixed point is kind of like proving that a continuous self-map of just the interval 0, 1 has a fixed point. So this is just a jazzed up version of that. And, well, okay, so now, there are actually quite a few cases here. I'm not going to go through all of them. But at least let's look at one of them. So this is, suppose that this fixed point is somehow lies in the interior. It's not an endpoint. Well, then it turns out there is an estimate which, actually in algebra is known as Izumi's inequality. But if you want, it can also be proved using a classical inequality of Skoda in terms of estimating the long numbers in terms of integrability exponents. In any case, you can prove that there is an estimate. So this estimate here is actually obvious by the norm. This is automatic by the normalization. But it's this estimate that's non-trivial, that you have here's a delta positive. And actually, once you have that, this theorem A is actually done, because if you just unwind everything you have, you're going to have this kind of bound, and that means that the lambda you have here. I mean, what does it mean to be a fixed point? You mean that it means that under the push forward, you have a constant here, a proportionality constant. But then you get this term estimate, and the lambda has to be C infinity. So there's some other case. You have to treat the case when the fixed point is at the boundary as well, and that you have to worry a little bit about that. But anyway. And there's something. Well, so here is a little bit vague. So in some sense, this fixed point is going to be an attracting fixed point. It's going to admit a small basin of attraction in a suitable topology here on this tree, and from that basin of attraction, you're going to be able to construct this. This is for theorem D. So I claimed that it was a suitable blow up and a suitable point on the blow up where you had nice local dynamics. Okay, so I mean, I'll have to try to explain that better later on. I can't really do it at this stage. Okay, so. So now we have to go back, after this, I want to explain, first of all, the structure of this evaluation space. I mean, where does this tree structure come from? There are actually quite a few ways you can do that, but anyway, so here's what I like to do. It's kind of more geometric point of view. So you have a composition of blowups, right? So maybe I'll just call this blowup, as I said. And so what you can do in that case, you have a dual graph of the exceptional divisor. So here's an example. I've blown up the origin a bunch of times, and maybe here I have five exceptional divisors, E0, E1, E2, E3, E4. So I can create some kind of simplicial complex, just one-dimensional simplicial complex, so where the vertices are the exceptional primes, and then you have an edge if you have an intersection point. So E0 is going to intersect E1, E3, and E4, which I hope is correct here. And you see, this has a tree. It doesn't have any cycles. You can just prove this inductively if you want. All right, so what can you say about this thing? Well, it has two kinds of structures, this dual graph. I mean, it's a tree, right? Because that means it has a partial ordering in some sense. And the root is going to be what you get when you first blow up the origin. I mean, you can fix the root to be that. But also it has a metric here that... there are actually two invariants you can associate to each exceptional prime here, and one of them is the order of vanishing of the maximal ideal along E. Right? And then it turns out that you define, if E and G are adjacent, so they intersect, if you define the distance to be 1 over these numbers, then, you can all define anything, so that gives a distance at least. And if you have things that are not adjacent, then you know that you just kind of compute the length, the sum of the lengths of the path. So the distance between E4 and E1 would be the sum of E1, E0, and E0, E4. Well, so for this to make sense, you want to have some compatibility. So that if you blow up more, then you want something good to happen. So here's, I try to illustrate So, okay, it's maybe a little hard to see. So here's x pi. I already have two exceptional divisors here. That gives you a graph just with 2 points. And maybe those are other things, but I'm just concentrating on this. And now I suppose I blow up for both the intersection point here, supposed to be green, and then the red point over here. I blow up those 2 points. When I'm blowing up the intersection point, I create this green exceptional divisor meeting those two. And if I blow up this point, I just create a new red one here. And that's going to give you the green one goes in between here, and the red one just sticks out. And then the statement is, well, first of all, you didn't screw up the order here. So, well, it's not much of an order here, so maybe this one is the minimal one. But maybe more, you also get an isometry. So the distance that you had in between those two guys is the sum of the distance from there to there and there to there. Well, so I'm not proving this, but it's just a simple calculation based on the definition. Okay? I mean, so you can embed one graph in another. Okay. So do I want this here? Okay. All right. Well, so then you can do more. What you can also do, which I'll try to explain here, is in fact you can embed. You can embed this dual graph itself. So now inside this set of valuations. So how do you do this? Also, you first look at the vertices. So vertex on this graph, so one of those guys here. I mean, that's an exceptional prime, and you associate it to it. Well, you like to associate this divisorial valuation, but you have to normalize it. And the way you normalize it is you divide exactly by this number, v. And that gives you a normalized divisorial valuation. So that's how you... No? But then you have the edges. Okay. So what you do here is, well, you have an edge, and what you can always do is you can... I mean, it's a line segment, and you have some length of it. But you can parameterize it in this way. So you parameterize it by s, t, so two real positive numbers, normalized by this condition here. So kind of barycentric, weighted kind of coordinates here. And given such a number st, then you can create a valuation, nu st, which is monomial in some coordinates upstairs. So I'm looking here, this is c2 at the origin, here is upstairs on some blow up, and I have e and f, say they intersect, and this is opposed to this, they intersect at some point, because that's why they're an edge. And then you can write in local coordinates, e is z equal to 0, f is w equal to 0, and then you just define, if you have a holomorphic function up here, then it's, you can expand it in the power series and just give weight S to Z and give weight T to J, to W. And then you take the minimum order and then there are no cancellations, so to speak. Okay. So you can check that you get an embedding of the segment inside the tree. And there's a compatibility you have to check here. So these coordinates you pick on the edge, I mean, if you blow up further, then you can subdivide an edge, and you have to make sure that this is compatible, but it is. All right. So in this way you get, this is just a definition. Basically, you take a union of all the valuations and you get from this set. If you prefer, it's an injective limit here, but think of it as a union. Those are called quasi-monomial valuations. They're kind of monomial in some model upstairs. Well, in some sense, yeah. I don't really want to talk about the Riemann-Zariski space here, but there would be, I mean, obviously there is a close connection, but...
For Poincaré, the Riemann-Zariski guy over
there, sorry, from a point in the Riemann-Zariski, so the Riemann-Zariski space would be... Yeah, but here, I mean, there are a lot of points in this Riemann-Zariski space, so it's not exactly. I mean, there are some subtle differences that I really don't want to get into. Yeah. So the Riemann-Zariski space can also be interpreted as a set of valuations, but you get too many valuations in this way, and it doesn't have any nice properties. All right. So what we have is. You get a lot of valuations this way, but in fact you don't get all valuations. So, but there is a kind of an interesting reverse construction, which I'll say less about. But so given a blow-up like this, or compositional blow-ups, and evaluation, you're going to have, you can define what's called a center of the evaluation on this space. So, so we can have if the evaluation happens to be a divisor evaluation associated with one of the primes, well, the center is going to be the prime. There's nothing there. Otherwise, what you can prove is that there is a unique point on the exceptional divisor such that the evaluation is strictly positive on the maxima ideal at that point. If you want, you can kind of put this into there are evaluative criteria on this and that and algebraic geometry, and it kind of falls into here. But actually, it's something you can just prove. So again, there is such a unique center. And in fine, if you refine this construction, what you can end up with, I'll try to illustrate in the picture, is that you actually have a retraction. So given any point, given any valuation, it's going to have some image on this dual graph. Okay. So here's, I'm not going to, so what you, I mean, what you have to do is that you define the center, but you also have to define, so the center is, so if I look at, so the, well, the corollary of this is that, well, so there's a theorem here which you can prove, which actually, if you just unwind definitions, it's not, there's not so much to it. But it's that the value to tree is, or this evaluation space is the projective limit of all these graphs. So what does it mean concretely? It means basically we take the union of all these dual graphs, and they're going to give you, trees, kind of growing trees. But that's not everything. But what you have to, the only thing you have to add is that you get a lot of endpoints that wasn't there. You just add all those endpoints. So at the corollary, you get an R tree, in which you have a partial ordering, have a metric. So here is kind of what I'm trying to illustrate. So here is a dual graph, which is some kind of finite object, and then kind of at any point here, maybe I didn't want to call this. It's a different way. So here's all this stuff that branches out from this point here are things that are going to be retracted onto this valuation under the retraction map. So here's a kind of two types. The quasi-monomial ones are the ones that you can find in a finite state. This is in some sense the interior, but not in a topological sense. It's just the points that are not endpoints. So there, and in fact, there are two. Well, I'm not going to define this specifically, but there are two types of valuations that you have to consider that are not quasi-monomial. There are the ones that are associated to a curve, a germ of a curve. So just in words, what you do is you have a curve of a germ of a curve, maybe singular, but irreducible at the origin. You have a holomorphic germ and you want to give some number. So what you take the holomorphic germ and you restrict it to the curve and then take the order of vanishing at the origin. So those are curve valuations. And then there's another type, which actually, well, it's the most complicated to define, but in some sense in dynamics, these are going to show up quite often as these invariant valuations, for example, for Hannon maps, in a lot of cases, it's kind of show up. But I don't really want to define them here. All right. So now, what you can do with this tree is something. There's a kind of nice. You can define. You have this R tree, and you can actually define some kind of geometric partitions of it. So, given a blow-up, a compositional blow-up, and a point on the exceptional divisor, and sometimes this is just classical terminology, such a point is kind of an infinitely near point, or a point that's infinitely near to the origin. Anyway, they can get an open subset inside this evaluation space here. And the definition is just formal like this. It's a set of valuations, nu, whose center on this space is P. Well, so what is it? You can just describe it concretely here. So suppose this is your x pi, and so you have so this is an exceptional divisor E, and then you have a point P on that, and it's not an intersection point or something else. Well, so dually, what that means is that you have in the dual graph you have E, or the valuation nu E, then that intersects two other things. But then you can imagine that if you would blow up P, you would get a new vertex here, and then you can kind of go blow up from this. So you can kind of see that you have one branch of the tree emanating in this direction, then you have infinitely many kind of branching things off from that, and U of P is all that stuff. And in the other case, when P is an intersection point between exceptional divisors, that means in the dual graph, you have a line segment between E and F, and then you kind of cut off, like, you get all these red branches that emanate from points that are kind of hidden here on this line. So you get this green V. And it turns out, I mean, so this will come out in very nice lately, later. So what you get is you get a partition of the value to tree and of this tree into, well, first you have all these vertices of the, as you're given a pi, you get all the vertices, and then you have these open subsets corresponding to points. So of course, it's an infinite partition because you have, as long as you have an exceptional divisor, you have an uncountable number of points there. But,
yeah.
This? It's inner.
Everything below E, like above.
What do you mean, A?
Well, I mean, it's just the same way that any open interval is an intersection to half open interval.
Yeah, so this would be a. Sometimes, yes. I don't think you always can realize these as an intersection of those two guys because you have to. You would have to be able to blow up. I mean, you have to make sure that if F was created by blowing up E, I think that, I mean, maybe then it would be true, or you could do the opposite, but you don't always know that. Right? So. But yeah, in some sense, it looks like, you could think of that, maybe geometrically, I don't think you geometrically can realize it this way, but you should, in terms of how it looks at the tree, it does look like this is an intersection of two of those guys. That's correct. All right. So now what you can also play a game. So if you make further blow-ups here, what you do is that you refine the partition. So I don't think I have a picture of that, but you can imagine that if you blow up some point here, you're going to get you get a new exceptional divisor, and then you get all the points on that exceptional divisor give you new regions. So you get a refine. Okay. So look here. All right, so now we want to go back to dynamics here to try to study it. So they have to start with a holomorphic fixed point germ, and you get an induced map on valuations. And I said that you had a lot of nice properties of this. Well, one thing you can do here is, well, suppose you have two different blow-ups, and not the same, they're a priori different. So what you get an induced map, F twiddle in between, and in general this is contract some curves and has some indeterminacy points. But what you can do is, now you pick two points, P and P prime, on those. So kind of like, situation is maybe like this. You have two points, and you want to check whether P is an indeterminacy point for this. And so then you have a very nice criterion here. Or it turns out to be a useful criterion, I should say. So you can say, and you say that it's a holomorphic at P and with image P prime, if and only if you have that this open set here, U of P, of course, for something like this, is mapped inside the other one. And actually, if you think about it, it's kind of natural because if this is not true, that means that it's basically some valuation if you have a point of indeterminacy, that means that you have a point somehow is sent to a divisor, but if you really think about it better, it's rather that it's an infinite near point, that's kind of something, you blow something up and then you get sent to an exceptional divisor, but that would exactly mean that this doesn't happen. And so somehow the picture here, so you want to have, so this opens that this is U of P in this case, and this is U of P prime. And you see that, of course, so having a small U of P gives you a good chance of getting inside this larger U of P prime. So what do you think? If you, by blowing up on the source space, you refine the partition, so you in some sense get a very small domain here, and that means that you have a bigger chance of being holomorphic, and that's kind of how it works. If you blow up the source space, you can get something holomorphic. If you blow up the target space, you kind of, it's the other way around. Then you probably not going to be holomorphic. So now, part of this executive summary was that the map on this valuation space preserves the tree structure. So I'll say something about how this works. I don't know how. So here's one thing. So there's a problem with the normalization here. So here I want to have taken segment inside the tree, and what I mean by ordered segment means that it doesn't pass through this. I have a preferred root of the tree. I don't want it to pass through there. And if it has a special property that this normalization factor CF is constant on here, and this actually happens, I mean, this is not very restricted in itself, then you can show that F, the induced map, maps this homeomorphically onto some other segment, and even in an order-preserving way. So here's a proof within quotes. So what is clear that this push forward map is order preserving. Anyway, maybe I didn't actually write down what was the partial ordering? I wrote it on the pullbacks, but what I write here. So what is new is less than or equal to new prime. This is if and only if kind of new of phi is less than or equal to new of the new prime of phi for all phi. So it's just kind of pointwise comparison. Right? So it's automatic that this is preserved under this push forward by F star. But when you normalize, in principle, that's not correct. But here, since the normalization is constant, you also get it here. It's order preserving. And somehow, order preserving really means geometrically that you kind of go along a branch. So somehow by continuity and preserving order, you kind of have to map it onto a segment. Right. Well, here is something that's a little bit deeper in a way. So this tree is huge, but there is a finite subtree where, in some sense, all the complicated behavior, at least in one iterate. So there's this finite subtree inside so that this function here is actually locally constant outside this. So locally, it means some topology. So what this means is that if you have a segment that doesn't intersect this finite subtree, then in fact you are in this situation. And moreover, this tree itself, this finite subtree, can be decomposed into finitely many segments itself, and on each of them, you get a homeomorphism onto the image. So you can have some kind of order reversing behavior there, but I don't want to really prove that, but there is a result here which is it's a bit like a desingularization argument, but I think the way we use it, it's a little bit more than that. So what you can achieve, so suppose you have your map here from C2 to C2, and whatever blow up you pick here, pi prime, you can always find this blow up here, so the map here is holomorphic. That's elimination of indeterminacy points, so that's fine. But what you can also do is you can actually make this here, this map, that it's locally monomial at every point on the exceptional divisor. And that's not an immediate consequence of that. It's not that bad, hard to do in dimension 2, but I believe actually this is formulated like this is not known in arbitrary dimension. I could be wrong, but I believe at least Kutkowski has a bunch of papers on monomialization of maps from dimension 3 to 2 and 4 to 3, etc. I'm not going to say exactly how this, but if you have a monomial map, the point is if you have a monomial map, somehow this becomes kind of easy game to play, that you have monomial segments are just map it in monomial segments and there's no problem. And here you have to put these things together. So in this sense, you preserve the tree structure. Alright, so now, the existence of the eigenvaluation itself is now not a big deal. So not a big deal. I mean, you have to think a little bit how to actually do it, because a tree is really kind of infinite. But here is a statement. Anyway, so there exists a fixed point for this action. And moreover, there are kind of two cases. Either the fixed point is kind of inside the tree, so it's not an end point. Or the second case is really, there is no fixed point inside the tree. And then, there is always a fixed point at the boundary, but somehow that means that that also has to be attracting. At least you have a kind of a small basin of attraction. So here is what I want. In the second case, the fixed point is an end point, and there is this kind of green region here. I mean, it's going to have a lot of branches coming out of it. And that is mapped into a strictly smaller region inside here. So everything gets sucked into. So, and by the way, I mean, there's R trees show up a lot in like hyperbolic geometry and other kinds of geometry. And there are various general results about, especially isometries or even groups acting on R trees by isometries. And there are, I mean, you can prove many more things than this in that setting. It's just that here it's not really in isometries, but still, it's not a problem to prove this. So I'll just say that you just work with a tree structure and everything. And all right, so now let's go back to this we kind of had on a slide before. So this is how this C of Fn grows. Remember, this is the order of vanishing at the origin of Fn. So if you write F to the n in a Taylor expansion, the first term will have order C of Fn. Right. So now assume that this fixed point is quasi-monomial, so in the interior, and you have this statement here that it's invariant. Well, that means that it's invariant on the pushboard by some lambda positive here. And that means that this normalization factor for Fn at that point, I mean, this kind of thing was a multiplicative cocycle, but since you are at a fixed point, this just is lambda to the n. And now, as I said, there's an inequality here, which you can reduce to this inequality by Skodai in this setting, assuming that it's a quasi-monomial evaluation. Otherwise, this is not going to be true in general. So the statement is that there is a positive delta here, so that you have this inequality. So the one is automatic, the other one is the constant here. And what I mean by this is, again, that whatever holomorphic function you plug in here, the value of that is less than or equal to the value of there. So order zero is the order of vanishing at the origin. Right, so now if you just plug these things in, so C of Fn, that's the order of vanishing of, I'm doing the pullback of the maximal ideal, but that's then greater than or equal to delta times nu star of the maximal ideal, and that's delta times lambda to the n. And on the other hand, you have this by the other inequality. So you see that the statement is that this C infinity is lambda, and then you have this. So that's the theorem, eh? And, so you have to modify this argument. It doesn't quite work when nu star is it's not quasi-monomial. For example, if it's associated to a germ of a curve, then you really have to use that it's an attracting fixed point. You can't just pick any fixed point. All right, so say something about the second. How do you get the normal forms, or how do you get this point? So here's the basic idea. So you have, now suppose that you have for simplicity, this is one of the cases, then the eigenvaluation, or this invariant valuation, is the quasi-monomial valuation, so it lies in some dual graph, but it will never become a vertex, so it's not divisorial. So it's kind of called an irrational, so it's non-divisorial. So it lies here, and for this kind of tree reasons here, so somehow there's only two branches emanating from new star. That's because it's the rational point there. Otherwise, there will be uncountably many. So if you take some very small segment I here, just for these kind of tree reasons that it preserves the tree structure, it will have to map into some slightly larger interval J. So just by picking I and J, so it's sufficiently small. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume here's actually a subtle point here, I'm going to cheat a little bit and replace F by F squared. So then you can make sure it's an order preserving here as well. Right, so then there's a claim here, and this is actually, so in fact, you don't have to work with two different I's and J's. You can put the same one in. So this is kind of a critical point, that was a crucial point of the argument, that you can map it inside itself. Also it turns out, so maybe it's possible there is a better explanation than this, but what we can do here is that inner parameterization of this I by some number T, basically by the distance on the dual graph that you had, then the map looks like a Möbius transformation. I mean, the denominator basically comes from this normalization constant, and you have something in the denominator, in the numerator. And all these are positive integers. And basically, in this case, when you have, if it's order preserving in particular, somehow this has to have an attracting behavior. It's kind of like, it's a bit similar to this theorem for Benius or something, if you have positive matrix, I mean, to say the matrix with integer coefficients here, A, B, C, D, it's going to map the first quadrant into the first quadrant. So if there is a fixed point, it can't be attracting. I mean, right. And then now if you have such a segment I here, you can associate a corresponding open set U, which is kind of all the stuff that emanates from I, kind of branches going on in different directions. And just by this preserving the tree structure, you see that will also have to be invariant if the I is chosen small enough. So far this is just, I mean, there is this thing about the being a Möbius map here, which is important. Otherwise, a lot of this is just arguments about trees. Right. So here, right. So then, what you can do is actually you can choose this U, which is just kind of given in terms of trees, of this geometric form. U associated to a point, an intersection point, an exceptional divisor. Basically, you just kind of follow this given new star. You can kind of approach it from the left and the right by suitable blow-ups, and you obtain this kind of thing. And then you see that when this is invariant, we had this criterion, and it shows exactly that F2 of the lift is holomorphic at that point, and maps it into itself. So you have your fixed point. And in fact, what you can make sure here, since you're allowed to take this region extremely small, you can make sure that the critical set of the lift is just these two axes, that are exceptional divisor, and you can, I guess I, this is supposed to be not the in forward image, but maybe I should just correct this here. So there's a negative one here. Locally. And then you have a rigid germ. And in fact, in this particular case, in rational, you can make this into a monomial map. And in that case, then you have a monomial map. So you have proved this theorem B that you have a nice point with a nice normal form. And in fact, you can also check that the lambda one is not lambda one, it's C infinity here. That's the spectral radius of this matrix, which is a quadratic integer. So you get the other theorem as well. All right, that's all.